Today, we're going to read a story in Acts about a storm. And speaking of storms, I don't know about you, I grew up in the Cary, Raleigh area, and so there's been a couple of hurricanes in my life that I've been a part of. The first one I really remember, I don't know if it was Fran or Floyd, it was one of the F hurricanes, and because they were both pretty big around here, and I just remember for one of those, me and my brothers, we slept in our parents' room because it hit like in the middle of the night, and fortunately for us, there was like a small like skinny tree that like landed on our house, didn't do anything, but I just remember that the next morning, me and my older brother getting on our bikes and biking around the neighborhood and just checking out like all the damage. And I remember that one of the houses had like this massive tree that like smashed through their ceiling. I also remember one of my friends had this big tree that like fell down in their yard, and it was there for like a month. And so we were like playing on this tree all the time, and nothing really like scary like health-wise to us, but I remember that. I went to UNC Wilmington on the coast, Wilmington, North Carolina, for college, and the first freshman year, that fall, they had a mandatory evacuation, which they can't like make you leave, but it's pretty much like, hey, you should leave. And so we left because a hurricane was coming that weekend, and it did absolutely nothing. It was like a whole bunch of nothing. And so my junior year, we had another hurricane come, and they had another one of those like mandatory evacuations. And so, of course, why would you leave when the first time didn't happen, do anything? And so a bunch of us like slept over at one of our friends' houses that had a house there. And at about midnight, when it was supposed to be the worst, all of us guys went outside and like ran around. And it was really just like a really windy rainstorm. So, you know, again, not much there. Probably the most annoying hurricane was a couple years ago, Christina and I went on a cruise. And for whatever reason, you know, you get there the first day, the first full day, I wake up and I'm sick. And I don't know what's going on, but I'm not like seasick, but I just like have a cold. And I'm sick for 3 days, and so that was miserable. And finally, the last full day at sea, I feel good. And so I'm like, finally, it's like one day out of this. The problem was there was a hurricane coming, and so the boat had to like go back faster to port. And because of that, our room was in the front of the ship. And so the ship was like a lot of movement because the waves were choppy. It was going a little faster than normal. And Christina was like super seasick. And we couldn't even be in our room because the front of the ship was like moving a lot. So we're like in the middle of the ship and she's miserable. And I'm like, this is a great, you know, glad we saved for this vacation. Fortunately, no death, like nothing like life-threatening, just kind of annoying. And today we're going to continue our time in the book of Acts, and we're going to literally read about a life-threatening storm and kind of see what wisdom does the scripture have for us in that. And so if you have a Bible, you can join me in Acts chapter 27. Acts chapter 27 is where we're going to be. If you don't have one, there's some black ones in the back of the auditorium. And if you don't own a Bible, listen, we'd love for you to take one of those black ones home. It is our gift to you. Today we're looking at how to respond when you are in the midst of a storm. And we are coming, this is the second to last chapter in the book of Acts, and so we are almost done with the book of Acts. And glad there's no applause there, because that would have been sad for me. I guess finally we're over with, and there's nothing there, great. And so listen, this has just been the story of the early church. The story we're going to read today is taking place about 59 to 60 AD. So this is roughly the last 25-ish years of the early church from Jesus' ascension back into heaven. And so we've been really tracking with Paul for the last several chapters. Right now, Paul is on the way. He's about to be on the way to Rome to stand before Caesar. We've been tracking with him. He was arrested unfairly by the Jewish people in Jerusalem. They couldn't find anything to charge him against other than blasphemy. But of course, Roman legal law doesn't care about Jewish religious squabbles. And so they couldn't come up with a charge. And so what they do is they send Paul to the governor of the area. And they kind of present their case before the governor. They find out, like, well, according to Roman law, Paul still has not done anything wrong. And at the end of chapter 26, we see the Roman governor basically say, if Paul had not appealed to Caesar, like, he could have gone free. He's not done anything wrong. But of course, Paul wants to go to Rome. He's been told by God he's going to share the gospel in Rome. And so he, as a prisoner, is going to be sent to Rome to finally, at some point, appeal before Caesar for the charges against him. And that's where we're going to pick up the story. So Acts chapter 27, verse 1, it says this. When it was decided that Luke is writing this. This is Luke, Paul, and some other traveling companions. We were to set sail to Italy. They handed over Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion named Julius of the Imperial Regiment. When we had boarded a ship of Adriatium, we put to sea, intending to sail to ports along the coast of Aristarchus. A Macedonian of Thessalonica was with us. The next day, we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and allowed him to go to his friends to receive their care. So here's what's going on here. Under great conditions, they're leaving from this town called Caesarea on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. I'll show you a map in just a minute. This journey to Rome would typically take about 5 weeks. As we're going to see, it's already about fall when this takes place. The year is about 59 to 60 AD. Julius is the Roman official in charge of the prisoners that are on the ship. So this is not just like a prisoner ship, but they have some prisoners on the ship that also need to go to Rome. So he's in charge of the prisoners. We see in verse 1 that, again, Luke says we. So he's talking about Luke and Paul. Aristarchus, who also, we're not sure, he may or may not be a prisoner at this point with Paul, but he is one of Paul's traveling companions. In fact, Paul mentions him both in his letter to the Colossians and his letter to the to Philemon. So there's multiple times where this same guy gets mentioned. There might be a handful of others as well, but they're going with Paul to Rome. Verse 3, we see at one of the stops, Paul is allowed to visit his friends in the town. So Julius shows favor to Paul. He likely respected Paul for various reasons. And so they're on their journey. Now, the next couple of verses are going to mention the various towns and ports that they stop in along the way. We see that multiple times the journey is very slow, so it's going much slower than they anticipated, likely because there was unfavorable weather, and it's very difficult. So I want to show you just a map really quick of Paul's journey here. They're starting out in Caesarea, they stop at Sidon, they stop at Myra, they stop at Cretus, and they're going to go to Fair Havens. So we're going to pick up the story at Fair Havens, and then the next week we'll see how he kind of ends up in Rome. But he's from Caesarea, Sidon, Myra, Cretus, and they're going to go to Fair Havens. So typically you wouldn't stop this many times, but the journey's been slow, the weather's been bad, and we're going to pick up the story in verse 9. When they are in Fair Havens, and it says this. This is on the island of Cyprus in the Mediterranean Sea. It says, by now, much time had passed, and the voyage was already dangerous. Since the Day of Atonement was already over, Paul gave his advice and told them, men, I can see that this voyage is headed toward disaster and heavy loss, not only of the cargo and of the ship, but also of our lives. So in verses 7, 8, and 9, there is a comment that Luke makes about how slowly things were going. This ship likely left around end of August or early September, which was a very normal time to depart for a journey of this length, but their progress, again, was unusually slow, given how many times they have stopped so far in the story. Now, the Day of Atonement is just a helpful reference here. The Day of Atonement was a massive Jewish holiday that they celebrated once a year. In the year of 59 AD, this took place on October 5th, and this is relevant if you're an ancient reader and you're kind of familiar with what's going on here. Basically, what this is saying is that this is getting very late in the year to be sailing in the Mediterranean Sea. Basically, in the ancient world, sailing was completely shut off in the Mediterranean Sea from November through March. And journeys were very rarely ever started in October. Now, the reason for this is because of the unpredictable and dangerous weather that happens in the wintertime in this part of the world. And we're going to read about one of the storms in just a minute. Also, you have very unpredictable storms that come very quickly, and we have a lot less daylight, and there's more cloud cover during the winter times in the Mediterranean Sea. So especially in the ancient world, navigating was very, very difficult. Unpredictable weather, you can't see the sun and the stars as much because it's cloudy a lot of time. So sailing essentially stops, again, especially with first century vessels. You know, they're not equipped maybe to handle the storms like they are today. Now, Paul is an experienced sea traveler. He is recommending to the people who are running the ship that they port for winter. Now, Paul's recommendation here, I don't think it's meant to be seen as a prophecy that God says we better port or else. He's just like been around a lot. In fact, we know by this point in Paul's life, Paul has already been a part of 3 shipwrecks. So he sails a lot. He kind of knows like, hey, this isn't going to go well. And so he recommends that, you know, they kind of stop. Now, they don't really listen to Paul, which, he kind of tells them. It's kind of like, again, it's like if you have the kids and you know that if your kid does this thing, this result's going to happen. And so what typically happens is like mom's like, hey, don't do this. And dad's kind of like, you know, it's probably good for you to get a little hurt, so you should do this, right? And so you kind of warn them and you know they're not going to listen and they do it anyway. That's kind of what Paul's going to say in here. He's like, I've been through a lot of these. We shouldn't do this. And so that's his recommendation. But of course, Paul's not in charge, and so they don't listen to him. Verse 11, if we keep reading, it says this. But the centurion paid attention to the captain and the owner of the ship rather than to what Paul said. Since the harbor was unsuitable to winter in, the majority decided to set sail from there, hoping somehow to reach Phoenix, a harbor on Crete facing the southwest and northwest, and to winter there. So basically, they're going to stay on the island of Cyprus, but they want to winter somewhere else against Paul's advice. Now, Unsurprisingly, they don't listen to Paul because he's a prisoner and he's not in charge. And so they don't really do what he says, and they continue on. Now, there's a couple reasons for this. There's some commercial pressure because there is a lot of grain on this ship, and so you kind of want to move as far as you can. You want to keep things going. We also know that the town of Lysias, which is where the port of Fair Havens was not a preferable place for sailors to winter at. I guess there just wasn't as much going on there. And so they also would rather stay in the city of Phoenix. And apparently, if they are going to winter there, the harbor in Phoenix is safer for their choppy weather than the harbor at Fair Havens. And so they recommend trying to leave somewhere. So they're like, hey, we could get stuck here. Let's kind of go. It kind of reminds me a little bit of when it's like our first or second year of marriage. And Christine and I, we were in Charlotte for something. And we had to drive back to Wilmington. And, you know, we had the iPhones, but, the service wasn't always as great. And we had the GPS thing. And our service wasn't good enough to, like, tell us where to go. And so we had, like, no service. And so the option is, like, well, what do? We kind of sit here or we kind of, like, try to drive and figure it out. And so I'm in the driver's seat, and we're sitting in this parking lot. And I asked Christina to hand me the map that was in the seat back in front of me. And it proceeds to a massive argument because she thinks I'm, like, joking. Like trying to be smart. She's like, you don't actually know how to read a map. And so we go back and forth because she doesn't know how to read a map. And she didn't think that like that's a thing that like most people knew how to do. And I'm like, no, like give me the map. We're going to read it. And then eventually at some point our phone's going to work. And it did work. Now, I don't have a map anymore because that doesn't really happen as much. So we'd be in trouble. But we read a map and we made it work and it was okay. Unfortunately, that's not what's going to happen here. And so they're going to go for it. It says this in verse 13. It says, when a gentle south wind sprang up, they thought they had achieved their purpose. In other words, it looked like a good decision to leave. They're making good progress, and so they're going for it. They weighed anchor and sailed along the shore of Crete. 14, but before long, a fierce wind called the Northeaster rushed down from the island. So these are the common winter storms that kind of pop out of nowhere. They spring up quickly. They would have sustained winds of about 40 to 60 miles an hour. Gusts can exceed 70 miles an hour. Again, not a great thing for these ancient ships. 15, since the ship was caught and unable to head into the wind, we gave way to it and were driven along. After running under the shelter of a little island called Cauda, we were barely able to get control of the skiff. After hoisting it up, they used ropes and tackled and girded the ship. Fearing they would run aground on Cyprus, they lowered the drift anchor and in this way were driven along. Now, here is the translation for us non-sailors. Things are going very poorly. Like, that's what's going on there. What I try to do, is, study the text and try to explain things that are going on. I was trying to understand, like, what's actually going on with the ship and trying to understand all these nautical terms. And can I just say, like, the best I can give to you is, like, it's not going well. I don't know what's happening here. It's stuff I don't understand, but things are not going out. Let me maybe make it more modern. I grew up, so when I first started driving, it was in the age of MapQuest. Anybody? Anybody MapQuest? All right. So what happened was, like, GPS, the iPhone, first iPhone came out, I think my senior year of high school. So like, not everyone was really using it. The GPSs were starting to be a thing. And so basically when I started driving, what you would do is you would go to mapquest.com and you would put in your address and then you would print out the directions. So it'd tell you to turn on this street, go here. And it works really great. It works really great until you miss a turn. Until you miss a turn. And then you're like, you have no idea how you're going to make your destination. You have no idea when you're going to get there. You have no idea where you were. So it's kind of like, Paul's situation here, except, when you miss the turn on MapQuest, you're not going to die. But it's like that. Like, I didn't know where to go. Or maybe to make it a little bit more modern, it's like, everyone's got the GPS in their phones now. So you put the address in your phone, and every road it tells you to go on, it's like construction. Or let's say you miss a turn, and so your arrival time like goes up and up and up. And so that's kind of like what's going on here, except, you're not going to die. And so that's what's happening here. Like, they don't know where they are. The things are not going well. I also just want to point this out. In this chapter alone, Luke includes more than 25 specific nautical terms or references, which is a striking feature showing his accuracy in the vivid detail as a firsthand observer. Just as a side note, sometimes people like to say, well, the Gospels, the letters in the New Testament were written way after the fact, probably sometime in the second century. And here's how we know that that argument doesn't have a lot of credence, because every time in the Bible of the things that we can verify, geography, typography, plants and vegetation, the Gospel writers in Acts always gets it right. They always get the details right. And so what you would assume if some story was made up way after the fact, somewhere way after these things happened, not by first-handed witnesses, either you would get the minor details wrong, or more likely, you would not include them altogether. Now, of course, we can't verify all the details that Luke gives here, but this is not a story of someone who's trying to make something up, because he's very specific about the issues they're running into. So they're having all these issues. Verse 18, we keep reading. It says, because we were being severely battered by the storm, they began to jettison the cargo the next day. On the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. Now, I looked this up. I can explain this. Here's what's happening. When you get rid of cargo, it makes the boat weigh less so that it can sit higher over the water, which does two things. One, it makes it less likely to hit submerged rocks and sandbars. And secondly, you're a little bit higher in the water, so you're less likely to take on too much water or capsize from the waves. So they lower the lessen the weight of the boat to try to stay safe. Verse 20, for many days, neither sun nor stars appeared. Now, what he's saying there is that it was very cloudy. So they couldn't see the sun during the day. They couldn't see the stars at night. So they have no idea where they are. They cannot navigate. And, he continues, the severe storm kept raging. Finally, all hope was fading that we would be saved. All hope is fading that we would be saved. Now, Luke here is describing a very literal storm at sea. But if we're being honest, here's what I know. If I'm reading a text like this, and you're sitting here, and you're thinking like right now, that maybe in some ways this sums up about how you feel. This is like how you're, the things you're experiencing in your life right now, you kind of feel like this in some ways. Like it could be a diagnosis that you or a loved one have. It could be a financial hardship. It could be depression. It could be relational strife. It could be a broken dream. Maybe things were going fine, and all of a sudden something happens, and maybe you got a phone call recently, and you have no idea what you are going to do. He says, finally, all hope was fading that we would be saved. And some of you, listen, man, you're there right now. Right now. That these sailors, they're caught in a storm. They have no idea where they are. And also, there is nothing they can stop to do to stop it. And there's nothing they can do to fix it. So they're in this hopeless situation, and there's literally nothing they can do. They've done all they know how to do, and they are still hopeless. They are still hopeless. They're still hopeless. And listen, I know that none of us would choose or prefer to be in a storm. So listen, some of you right now, man, that is your story. Like, you're feeling that right now. And you would never choose to be in a storm. But Scripture also does tell us that at the same time, sometimes a storm is exactly what we need. Now, when I say that, we've got to be able to understand that according to scripturally, we can hold two things in tension. So the tension of like, hey, this is really hard and I don't know what's going to happen and I'm doubting and I've got grief. Like, you can hold on to that as a Christian. And at the same time, that there might be something in this storm that God wants to teach me and use in my life. That both of these things can happen together. We don't need to downplay the hardship, but nor do we need to downplay that God might be doing something. This is the tensions we see all throughout Scripture. Let me give you a couple really quick verses. In 2 Corinthians chapter 1, the Apostle Paul is talking about some hardship that he and some of his friends are going through. And he says this. He says, we were completely overwhelmed beyond our strength so that we even despaired of life itself. Indeed, we felt that we had received the sentence of death. Well, and here's why. Why? So that we would not trust in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead. Now, here's why Paul can say this. Because if the tomb is empty, anything is possible. Anything is possible. So they're hopeless. But their hopelessness is pointing them to the resurrected King. Psalm 34, 18, it says this, the Lord is near the brokenhearted. He saves those crushed in spirit. Deuteronomy 8, 3, this is Moses to the Israelites as they're making their way through the wilderness to the promised land. He says this, he, talking about God, humbled you by letting you go hungry. So notice, like, originally in the wilderness, they're like really hungry. God could have fixed it earlier, but he lets it happen. Then he gave you manna to eat, which you and your ancestors had not known. And here's why. So that you might learn that man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. In other words, he was teaching you that you need him. You need him. Psalm 107, this is a great psalm because it's in this part of Psalm 107, verses 20 and 28, it's talking about sailors who were at sea. It says, they reeled and staggered like a drunkard, and all their skill was useless. So they're in the ship. Things are not going well. It looked like a drunk person was guiding the ship because they couldn't control it. Verse 28, then, so in their hopeless situation, these group of sailors, then they cried out to the Lord in their trouble, and he brought them out of their distress. God brought them out, not their effort, not their figuring it out, not their white-knuckling it, not their self-will. He brought them out of their distress. I'll give you one more. Jonah chapter 2. Jonah is recounting the time when he was in the belly of the fish. He says this in verse 2. He says, I called to the Lord in my distress, and he answered me. I cried out for help from deep inside Sheol. You heard my voice. Verse 6, he says this, I sank to the foundations of the mountains. The earth's gates shut behind me forever. Then you raised me from the pit, Lord my God. In other words, I think part of the tension that we see here in the scriptures is this, that you and I should let your hopelessness lead you to true hope. This is the invitation. In the midst of your doubt, your struggle, your grief, that you would allow your hopelessness to lead you to the one who actually and only can actually provide you true hope. In fact, in some ways, hopelessness, our hopelessness, is the most honest place to be because it reveals the reality that you could never fix it anyway. And nobody would choose to be in a hopeless situation. Nobody would choose to be going through something really hard and difficult. But what it does do is that it does give you sight to the fact that you cannot control things anyway. It's why the famous hymn that says this, my hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. I dare not trust the sweetest frame, but wholly lean on Jesus' name. Listen, the good news of the gospel is that this is what Christ does for us. While we were still sinners, while we were hopeless, while we were headed toward death, Jesus came to do for us what we could not do for ourselves, that he lived a perfect life you and I could not live, took the loving wrath of God against sin, evil, and wickedness, and raised 3 days later to show his victory over death so that anyone who trusts, confess their sin and trust in the Lord may be saved. And you are saved by his grace, not your effort. You are given the hope of God, not by trying better or promising to do better in the future, but by God's grace in you, given through Jesus. And so listen, all of us either have or are right now feeling some sort of hopelessness about something going on in your life. And I can just like share this message. Like, you're here at New City Church. New City Church arised out of like a hopeless situation that was not given up on. I still remember in October of 2016, we had like a really small launch team. We weren't raising any money. We're trying to figure out what to do. And so I remember Christine and I having conversations with multiple people being like, I don't know that we should like try this thing out. It's not working. Maybe we can start meeting in our town home. And it felt like, man, this isn't going to work. And I just remember thinking like, we could kind of pull the plug on this thing and never really get off the ground. But, you know, I'll get another job. Maybe I'll just get a job, go back, get another job, and maybe we'll just, like, meet on Sundays, and whoever wants to show up, maybe we'll do that. But we just kept thinking of people, like, there was a girl on our launch team who was a Muslim and had never known Jesus, never heard the Bible, never read the Bible. And we were just like, well, if we, like, give up on this thing, like, where's she going to go? And there was these people that, like, were, like, really taking significant strides in their faith that they hadn't before. And we were like, man, if we give up on this thing, like, where are we going to go? Where are they going to go? And so we kept to it, even though it felt for a long time very, very hopeless. And I just want to say this, listen, you can grieve, you can struggle, you can ask questions, while at the same time experiencing the only true hope we have, and that is in Jesus Christ. You can do both of these things, and you should not downplay either one. We see in the scriptures this encouragement that you should let your hopelessness lead you to the one who actually can give you true hope. And so that's what's going to go on here in Acts 27. I mean, these guys are like on the way to death. They don't know what to do. And so verse 21, if we keep reading in Acts 27, it says this, verse 21. It says, since they had been without food for a long time, so this is probably a combination of loss of food, so they're trying to ration it, and sickness and not wanting to eat just because of all the stuff that's going on, fear for their life, you know, all that. It says, Paul then stood up among them and said, you men should have followed my advice not to sail from Crete and sustain this damage and loss. Now, I don't think Paul's like saying, yeah, good job, guys. I think Paul, what's going on here is Paul's reminding them, hey, you didn't listen to me when I said this. Now I'm going to say something else to you, and I need you to listen this time. So he reminds them, hey, you should have listened to me the first time you didn't. I need you to listen to what I'm about to say. Verse 22. He says, now I urge you to take courage, because there will be no loss of any of your lives, but only of the ship. In other words, Paul's like, listen, I got good news and I got bad news. The good news is, if you're wondering if you're going to survive, you are. The bad news is the ship is going to be destroyed. Now, I just want to say this. If you're an ancient sailor and you're being told that the ship is going to be destroyed, you're going to have a very hard time believing that you're somehow going to survive. Especially in the ancient world, many sailors did not know how to swim. I don't know if you know this, they didn't have like community swimming pools in the ancient world. There's also a lot of superstition about learning how to swim as a sailor is like kind of like bad luck. Like if I learn how to swim, then that just means I'm going to be in a shipwreck. So a lot of these guys are like, if you're telling me the ship's going to go down, I'm not quite sure how in the world that means I'm not going to die as well. But that's what Paul says. And here's the confidence Paul has. Okay, verse 23, here's why Paul tells them this. He says, "For last night, an angel of the God I belong to, and I serve, stood by me and said, 'Don't be afraid, Paul. It is necessary for you to appear before Caesar. And indeed, God has graciously given all those who are sailing with you.'" So that's the vision, the message he got from the angel, that Paul's going to survive because he's going to make it to Caesar, and everyone on the ship is going to survive too. So he tells them, verse 25, he continues. He says, "So take courage, men, because I believe God. I believe God that it will be just the way it was told to me, but we have to run aground on some island." So here's Paul, right? Paul says, listen, we are in a hopeless situation, but I have hope. And here's why. Because of my God. Because of my God. Now, we have no idea what this appearance to Paul by the angel looked like or what that went down. We don't know. But for Paul, here's what Paul's thinking. My God is greater than any storm or trial. And in this situation, he told me what will happen, and I trust him. And I will trust him. And I just want to point this out. Listen, it's easy for us to say, well, Paul knows better. Listen, he's in the midst of a storm. They have no idea where they're going to go. Even if an angel visits him, he still has to choose to trust. Because he has no idea how this is actually going to work out. And I would also maybe say this. You also might say, I might say, as we're reading this text, well, it's easy for Paul to say, like, I'm going to trust God because he literally had an angel told him what was going to happen. So, like, yeah, sure, great for him. And I would say, yes, there is a part of that may maybe inspire confidence. But I would also say this. How many times was he faithful in his life when he had no voice from an angel? Like, there are many times where he did what God was leading him to do, what he felt the Spirit was leading him to do, having no idea how it was going to work out. And I maybe just want to say this too, to press it a little bit more. You might say, well, easy for Paul to say he had an angel. Okay, how many times over the course of your life did you have a parent or a friend or a spouse tell you what was going to happen if you made a certain decision and you made it anyway? How many times? Right, you knew what was going to happen, but because you desired that thing or you justified it in your mind, like it's going to be okay because I want to get this thing, I want to do it, or you just thought you could make it work, right? You didn't trust the wisdom of other people in your life, and so you did what you shouldn't have done, and you found yourself in a really difficult situation. And so, yes, Paul was visited by an angel, but he is still actively placing his hope and trust in the Lord, even though right now in his situation, there is nothing about it that says they're going to be okay. So he trusts the Lord. Now, what happens next is 2 weeks after Paul makes this speech. And I just love to point this out. We said this maybe a lot at New City, that sometimes we get frustrated with God because we assume if B is going to happen and we're at A, that it's going to look at this certain way. Then we get mad at God because it doesn't happen the way that we assume it's going to happen, even though God never said it was going to happen that way. I would assume if it's been like a couple of days already and like things aren't going well, we're in a ship and an angel visits me and says everything's going to be okay, that's going to be probably the next day, maybe 2 days later at the most. It took a whole 2 stinking weeks. Like, you have to be like, did I hear something wrong? Like, was it the pizza? Like, what's going on here? For 2 weeks, nothing happens. 2 weeks later, finally, after Paul makes his speech, some of the sailors believe they were approaching land, and so they drop some anchors. Verse 29 says they prayed for daylight to come because, like, it's been a long time, probably 2.5 weeks now. Things are not going well. It's nighttime. They think there's land. So they pray for daylight to come. They put down some anchors. And then it says this, verse 33. When it was about daylight, Paul urged them all to take food, saying, "Today is the 14th day that you have been waiting and going without food, having eaten nothing. So, verse 34, I urge you to take some food, for this is for your survival, since none of you will lose a hair from your head." In other words, he's saying, eat, because you'll need the strength for what is about to happen, and you're going to live. So eat for what's going to happen. Verse 35, after he said these things and had taken some bread, he gave thanks to God in the presence of all of them. And after he broke it, he began to eat. They were all encouraged and took food themselves. Verse 37, in all there were 276 of us on the ship. When they had eaten enough, they began to lighten the ship by throwing the grain overboard into the sea. So finally, everyone is doing exactly what Paul is telling them to do. Even though it's like they got to trust him and his God, they don't really know. They just have to do it, so they're doing it. Then daylight comes. They see land. They don't know where they are or what land it is. The ship, what happens next is, so they're going to this land. The ship gets stuck on a sandbar, and then it begins to finally break apart because of all the waves and all the stuff that's been going through. So it's stuck on a sandbar. It begins to break apart because of the pounding of the waves. And then verse 42, if you look down at 42, here's how the chapter ends. It says, the soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners so that no one could swim away and escape. So the soldiers would have been held accountable for the prisoners, and if the prisoners escaped, most likely the soldiers would be killed. And so they don't want to die. So they kill. They're going to kill the prisoners. 43, but the centurion kept them from carrying out their plan because he wanted to save Paul. Now, this is fair, considering they'd all be dead without Paul. So, you know, that's fair. He wants to save Paul. And so he ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and to get to land. The rest were to follow, some on planks and some on debris from the ship. In this way, everyone safely reached the shore. God was faithful to his promises in the midst of the storm. Now, for this text, I want to give maybe couple takeaways that we can learn from what's going on here. It's an interesting story, but you might be like, hey, it sounds great, but like, what does this mean for me? And how does this apply to my life? So a couple things. Again, I just want to reiterate. First thing we already saw is that we should let our hopelessness lead you to true hope. That's what we should do. Also, I just want to point this out. Another thing we can learn from this passage is that no matter what you are going through, you can believe God today. You can. This option is before you. Again, if you read back in verse 25, it says this. Paul says, so take courage, men, because I believe God that it will be just the way it was told to me. So in the midst of a hopeless situation, he has chosen to believe God no matter what he is facing. Now, of course, unlike Paul, you may not have had a word from the Lord telling you how your specific situation will turn out. But we are promised in the scriptures that God loves you as evidenced by Jesus' sacrifice on the cross for you, and that one day all mourning and tears will turn into joy. This is our promise. Our promise is also this, that no matter what you may be going through, no matter why you might not understand like why this is happening, here's what we do know, that whatever you're going through is not because God doesn't care, because if God did not care, he would not have come. But he has come for you. Again, remember, even Paul's believing in God in verse 25 did not prevent Paul from the extreme hardship they were all still going to endure for the next couple of weeks on the ship. But it gave him endurance and hope in the midst of the storm. It gave him hope in a hopeless situation. So I do want to say this. As hard as it may be, you actually do have the option of believing God today. That is an option in front of you. It could be hard. It could be difficult. You could have a lot of doubt. You could be like, I'm not sure how you're going to do this. But the one of the options before you that Satan does not want you to know is that you still can trust God today in the midst of it. You can believe God today. That's what we see. And the other thing we see here is this, that God may not calm the storm, but he can sustain you through it. This is what we learned from Acts 27, really a bunch of times in the book of Acts, bunch of the times as we read through the scriptures, that God may not calm the storm. He may not do what you want him to do, but he still can sustain you through whatever you're going through. Listen, trusting and walking with God is not a promise that things will go better. That's not the promise. But the promise is that he will be with you, that he will be with you, that he will go before you, that nothing you are going through right now is a surprise to him, is a shock to him, that he knows exactly how it all will play out. And can I just encourage you this morning, church, that one of the roles of the church is to be with you, to be the presence of Jesus with you through it. Listen, you are doing yourself a severe disservice if you think showing up on Sunday is about karaoke and listening to a TED Talk. A, because you can listen to a lot better TED Talks. I just would say that, right? Like, that's not what it is. The body of believers coming together, following Jesus in community, loving, serving, grieving, praying with each other, man, this is part of the way we weather the storm. And so here's what we're going to do. As always, in a second, when I end, we're going to have people down front for prayer. And can I just say, like, man, if you have a storm in your life, you should get prayer for it. Like, can I just lovingly say, like, what are you doing standing there? Like, we are on your team here. Like, you should not let your pride of what are people going to think, or I'm sitting in the middle of the aisle, or we should not let our pride from experiencing the blessings of God. Again, in James chapter 4, verse 2, it literally says this: you do not have because you do not ask. Now, there's a lot going on in James, and so we have to understand the context. This is not like you always get your prayers answered, but this is, there are times in your life that you have not received the blessing, favor, or answer to prayer from God because you didn't ask. Or can I push it a little bit more? You only asked on your terms. In other words, at night, when no one's around, nobody knows you're struggling, but just you and God. Could it not be that part of what God answering your prayer, he wants other people to know what's going on so that they can celebrate too, that they can also be encouraged that God still answers prayers too? I just want to say this, as our church, would we not be a church that has not because we do not ask? Like, shame on us. Would we not be a church that has not because we do not ask? So here's what we're going to do as we end. We're going to sing here in a second, and we're going to sing about the promises of God. And maybe your worship, this worship time, is just a prayer. Like, God, I don't know, but I'm going to trust you, and I'm going to praise you, but I don't know that God's promises are true. In fact, in James chapter 5, it says this: is anyone among you suffering? He should pray. Is anyone cheerful? He should sing praises. And says anyone, if there's any one of you sick, you should come and pray and ask for prayer from a righteous person. So in a second, we are going to sing and we are going to pray. And would we be a people of God who don't just like stand there because it's like, oh, it's this time to sing and I've got lunch plans and I got this attitude. Like, we can assault the throne room of the living God, or we could sit there, arms crossed, being like, hey, this is great. I can't wait till church is over. Listen, the loving King of the universe came to rescue you. And I'm not a faith healer, but I am a Bible believer. And so here's what I want to do. We're going to pray. And so those of you that are doing the prayer team, would you go ahead and come up front right now? In a second, we're going to pray together. And when we pray, I just want to say this. Listen, if you have something in your life, like, don't wait. Like, when I pray, I want you to invite you just like to go ahead and come down to pray to the living God. Will we be a people who take our sin, our shame, and our hopelessness and go before the God who loves us? Will we not hide and cower in fear, but will we be the people of God who praise the King of the world who came for you? So would everyone, would you stand to your feet with me? Would you stand to your feet? And I'm going to pray. And if you have a prayer need, if you have a hopeless situation, I'm just going to ask you to come down front. Don't wait. Like, let's go before the throne of God and let's pray and sing the promises of God in our life. Would you pray with me? Jesus.